Hey, how's it going? Welcome back to the Football Diary podcast. This is Mike with Miles and Dave. It's a full house for the first time in a while. Good to see you both, guys. We are going to talk about the Premier League teams that all seem to be in the US at the moment on pre-season tour, and zoom in particularly on Manchester United and Aston Villa, fittingly, considering we're fans of each of those. The Lionesses are at the World Cup and progressing well. They scored a 1-0 win against Denmark, a really tricky tie. So we'll be zooming in on that game, and in particular, the Kira Walsh injury and how much of a concern that will be. And also rumblings in the transfer market, in particular Rasmus Højlund, Dave, which is where we'll start now, who has all but been confirmed as moving to Manchester United from Atalanta. The fee is huge, isn't it? I don't know the exact numbers, but it's over £70 million. And I had it in my head that it was going to be somewhere around the 50 mark. And I think if you were talking about it as, say, someone like Ajax signing him, you'd probably expect them to pay about 40, 50 million and him to do well there. And you to go, do you know what? That's a good potential signing. But why has Erik ten Hag felt like it was necessary to pay that money for him, do you think? What do you think he's looking to bring to United, and what's his vision for his role at the club?
Well, the murmurs that are coming out is that I think, obviously, the coach was quite impatient and he just wanted the deal over the line in the end. There's been a lot of noise around this player for a few months, hasn't it? I know we spoke about him in the pod on a couple of occasions a few months ago now. Obviously, when he made his international debut, obviously scored that hat-trick, and there was a lot kind of attention on him then. A new Højlund, especially with the name as well. It's kind of a bit poetic, really, that we've got two of these players in the Premier League now. One who's obviously a lot more unknown.
Careful, Dave. Don't everyone give him that hype already.
But I just feel as though United, particularly, you know, over the last few years, we know how bad they've been at dragging transfer sagas out, making them sagas when they really shouldn't be. But how careless we've been with fees and splashing money on players when it shouldn't be, we shouldn't have been paying anywhere near the money that we have done. I think we've done a little bit better this summer. We've actually got the players in kind of a little bit quicker. Although it would have been nice to have had a striker in near the start of the window.
Yeah.
Can I interject there that it's easy to get players in quicker if you're willing to massively overpay for all of them, because the selling clubs are happy to snap your hand off for these mad offers?
I don't doubt that we're interested in him, but I do think that the priority was Harry Kane, and it's kind of well known that that was the case. I think we've probably been in for both, but the fees that have kind of been bandied about Kane have obviously kind of put us off that path. But I don't think it's an outrageous fee for the talent that he's touted as being obviously a really, really top bracket in terms of kind of potential. Especially probably arguably the most difficult position to play and score goals, and which is obviously what he's been brought in to do. I think it's about £65 million up front, and then with obviously add-ons, difficult to achieve add-ons, I think it could take it up to around 75-80 million. And if it does get up to that, then it's money well spent at the end of the day. But I feel like it's just something we've definitely needed somebody in, because even if you look last season, look at the amount of goals he's scored, 58 goals in the Premier League. Considering Rashford obviously scored a big bulk of those, it's you know.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? The value of a player is only dependent on how desperate the team wants him, and obviously how desperate he wants to go to the team as well. And I think we've heard that he's a United fan. I don't know how true that is, but he definitely wanted to move to United exclusively, really. So the deal was pretty much agreed in terms of personal terms quite early on. It was just that fee that had to be narrowed down. And obviously Atalanta knew they had a real asset on their hands. He hasn't scored many goals in Serie A, and that's been used as a stick to beat him with, really, hasn't it? But when he burst on the international scene last year, his goals for Denmark were really impressive, and his mobility and his pace and explosion of kind of turn of pace when he moves is very reminiscent of Haaland, isn't it, in some ways?
I think
and exactly the kind of player United need.
Yeah. I don't think it's that he's not scored enough goals. I think from what I saw from like minutes played, it's actually not a bad rate.
No, of course not.
That he's actually scored the amount of goals he's scored.
But when the fee's up there, like, yeah, you're going to look at it in a different way, aren't you? And if we had paid £50 million for him, we'd have been investing in potential and you'd have seen that potential. So you kind of think, well, that's the going rate for an up-and-coming number nine, especially. Number nine's a really... it's really short of talent, I think, at the elite level for clubs like Manchester United to go and look for. So you do have to look for unproven talent. He's not yet proven, but you can it's clear to see what he can do, isn't it, Miles? You can see what he could bring to the Premier League, right?
You absolutely can. And like you say, buying potential is a smart thing that United should be doing in the market. They shouldn't be going to European clubs to buy young players that have already had a few seasons in there all the time, because that's how they end up overpaying. Yeah. But that's what they're doing here. If they'd signed Hoyland a year ago because of a good scouting network, they would have been paying pennies for him and would have had the same player. But United, for all they do right commercially on the business front, they're terrible at transfer dealings. We're talking about a club that have just spent nearly 60 million on a player in the last 12 months of his contract from Chelsea, who they kind of wanted rid of, wasn't part of their plans by the looks of things. They're now paying 70 million for someone who was outscored by Ademola Lookman in this Atalanta side last season. I just think it's not to say that I don't think Hoyland will be an excellent player in the future, but spending that kind of fee right now is dangerous. It's risky because we don't know how well he'll adapt to the Premier League. He's still at an age where one big injury ruins his career and we don't really know what the best of him is. But it's a massive, massive outlier for a player that we're yet to see hit the heights of the players he's being compared to. I think it's going to be really dangerous for him that he's moving over to England with a huge price tag and obvious aesthetic comparisons to Erling Haaland, but not much else. You talk about play style, and I do agree with that, because he's got a big frame, he's still very nimble, he's got explosive pace, he's definitely a finisher, but nowhere near the level that we saw Haaland at that age. And just because they're in Manchester, they're Scandinavian, kind of some similarities in their makeup, imagine coming to Manchester United, one of the biggest clubs in the world, with that price tag, at that age, being compared to a player that just broke the Premier League goal scoring record. And actually, there is nothing in your club career to suggest that you could match those heights yet.
I have to agree to an extent. I think that the fee adds that real unnecessary pressure, and the comparisons with Haaland don't help as well. The
no, poor guy,
he's too young for that, really. So yeah, the fee does make me feel a little bit concerned for him more than anything. I don't doubt he's the right profile, the right playing style for United, and he's the kind of player we need. However, this brings me on to the next topic, really, Miles. Harry Kane's really the kind of player that would slot almost instantly into United's attacking play at the moment. So is he somebody that will move to United maybe in 12 months' time for free, or is he on the move as well? What's your take on the Kane situation?
So it looks like it's almost done with Bayern in terms of an agreement. The move's still nowhere near being done by all accounts because it's early stages. But by the sounds of things, Bayern are really optimistic that they've agreed a fee with Tottenham and could agree personal terms with Kane. I wonder if that opens the market up a little bit for him. We know Tottenham are notoriously difficult to deal with, and Kane has been here before, where he should have had his move to Man City and it fell through because Tottenham dug their heels in. I think once clubs get a whiff of the fact that they are willing to cash in on him this summer, you mentioned earlier how limited the number nine market is. I wouldn't be surprised to see more teams knocking on the door then. And actually, maybe some Premier League teams. I don't know about Man United. It's difficult because it makes so much sense.
Yeah,
he'd be perfect for them. Hoyland could come in with a bit less pressure and learn off Kane. That would be fantastic, although it's a big amount of money to spend on two strikers in one window. But United have essentially got no strikers right now. And if you want to compete at the top level, you need depth everywhere. So I think the move to Bayern does make a lot of sense from their squad's point of view. But whose squad wouldn't benefit from having Harry Kane in it right now?
Yeah,
he automatically, other than Spurs, because they always manage to Spurs it up, he automatically should guarantee that you're competing at the top level because he's one of the best number nines in world football. So if you have the right squad around him and the right management structure, then I absolutely think any club in Europe would be lucky to have him. I'm surprised there's not been more interest in him yet, but I do think that's just because it's Spurs. I don't know. Does Hoyland affect Man United's interest in Kane? That depends on what their budget can stretch to. If they could get both, I wouldn't be surprised to see them come in with a bid. Yeah. But then there are loads of clubs. Maybe Juventus offload Vlahovic and they come in for him and try and bring him to Italy. If Bayern are the level, then why aren't Juve? If PSG try and offer in a move if Mbappe goes. I don't know. I feel like there should be far more suitors for Harry Kane than there currently are.
I feel like Harry Kane, though, personally needs to go, and he probably wants to go to a team that is in a realistic chance of winning the Champions League, because the main reason for him moving is for personal glory now, isn't it? He's got no trophies to his name. Poor guy. You know, he deserves something.
Hang on, they just won the Gold Tiger Cup or something, didn't they?
Don't give me that. But I mean, if he goes to Bayern, it's almost, and this is no disrespect to, you know, Leipzig or Dortmund or any other contenders, but he's almost guaranteed to win the Bundesliga. So there's been some
disrespect there.
Yeah, there is. There's a lot of snobbery towards whether going to Bayern is something that's ambitious for him. But Bayern are kind of one of those teams, the very few teams that are in with a realistic chance of winning the Champions League as well, because their squad is so good. I honestly don't think if he went to Manchester United, he's going to get anywhere near close to winning the Champions League, even the Premier League. So, you know, from a personal ambition point of view, Bayern makes sense.
Can you see anyone catching City in the Champions League at the moment?
Maybe Bayern.
I don't know how realistic anyone's chances are, if I'm honest. Because you're right, Bayern have been smart in the window. They've brought in some good players. But look at how close Dortmund ran them in the league last season. They don't seem overly settled. Obviously, Sadio Mane looks like he's on his way out, so it opens up a spot in the attacking line. The midfield, it seems like all of them are being linked away with the club. Every time I look at something, Kimmich and Goretzka both look like they have moves on the cards if they wanted them. I don't know if Bayern are as guaranteed to be at the top in the European competition, because they looked miles off it against City last year. I know they've strengthened since then. Kim In-jae is a great sign-in. They've got in Lima and Rafael Guerrero as well. So they are doing things in the market, but is it enough to compete with City or PSG or Real Madrid. Say again.
City probably need a couple of attackers in. Real Madrid is just...
Yeah, probably.
There's still obviously talk of Bernardo Silva potentially on the way out. So, you know, who do they bring in if I just think
if you're Harry Kane and you're now looking at your legacy and what you want to achieve from your career, you could go to Bayern Munich and win the Bundesliga for 3 years and then maybe come back to England at some point if you fancied another chance at the Premier League. Or, I don't know, I feel like there are better projects for European football than Bayern Munich right now, if I'm honest. Well, because Bayern Munich are ruthless and they don't seem consistent in a project. They brought in a young manager that they were going to build a legacy around and then change their mind after a year. Who's to say Tuchel will be there that long? I feel like Bayern are really inconsistent. I would rather look... Realistically, the sad thing is the best club for Harry Kane right now is probably Arsenal, but that's never happening.
The talk was that apparently Carlo Ancelotti made him his number one striker target. And apparently...
Yeah, and then Mbappé is throwing a spanner in the works.
Yeah, that's the thing. It affects so much of the number nine market, doesn't it? This Harry Kane move and what happens next. It really does.
That's the thing for me. I think Harry Kane would be a better fit than Mbappé at Real Madrid at the minute. Because if you're looking at them potentially moving Vinicius Jr. out of his favoured position to accommodate Mbappé.
Yeah, and obviously with Benzema out of the picture in Madrid as well, there's no obvious replacement for him. Not like for like, anyway. Kane seems like it's slotting quite nicely, so... Yeah.
You got to remember, though, it's Real Madrid we're talking about, and the commercial profile of a player means everything, and his age will mean everything. This is a World Cup winner, one of the best players in the world, and Harry Kane, as excellent as we all know he is, isn't of the same profile. He just isn't.
Well, the way that Kylian Mbappe has conducted himself, though, mate, in the last 2 years, is no way near as professional and easy to manage as Harry Kane. So maybe you look at the Kylian Mbappe transfer. No, I know. But this is Ancelotti as well. I don't know how long he'll be there, to be fair, because I know Brazil are eyeing him up, aren't they?
I think it's confirmed.
It'll
be the fee that's putting Real Madrid off, no doubt.
Yeah.
Because
it's the whole package, though.
Say, if he was on a free this season, I think he'd already be there at Real Madrid.
Do we think that he's just going to go to Bayern then? Or do you think United might come back in for him?
No, I think United would wait and see the lay of the land after this summer. And if he's still at Spurs this season, they'll get him on a free next season. I think that would suit Kane as well, to be fair. Won't suit Spurs, obviously. But
I think that would be backwards from United, if I'm honest. If you're going to get him, you've got to get him now. There's no point playing Hoyland for a year to move him out for Kane in 12 months' time. You've got to do it the other way around. Give Hoyland the time to develop with Kane.
Don't think the budget's there.
Maybe that's the problem, because they spank so much in other areas, it feels like.
Yeah, actually, on that note, let's go back to United, shall we, Dave? Spanked quite a bit on Andre Onana, not quite the 50 million mark, but good business. And I think it's an area of the team we needed to sign. Obviously, David De Gea left the club. The style of play was always pivotal on the goalkeeper, really, wasn't it? Erik ten Hag's philosophy depended on a goalkeeper like Onana. Clearly, they've got history with Ajax as well. It made sense. Now, pre-season has happened. We've seen Onana in action a couple of times, haven't we? Came on in the second half against Dortmund most recently. What do you make of him, Dave? Because it's a real departure from what we've seen, isn't it? I feel so nervous seeing the ball played out from the back anyway as a United fan. But with that defence, it still leaves me jittery. And, you know, with good reason. The way we conceded against Dortmund was awful, wasn't it? So Onana's got his work cut out. But where do United sit now? They've got him in between the sticks.
I think it's everyone's still nervous because they know what we've been used to for the last 8-9 years. it's quite an interesting one, really, because obviously when De Gea first came in from Atletico, he was actually renowned for being quite good on the ball. But it's almost like it kind of got, it wasn't continued to be coached. Obviously at the time when, obviously, you know, Alex Ferguson, it wasn't really known for goalkeepers to play the way that they do now.
Yeah.
So, but if you look at, it's a completely refreshing sort of outlook of the team now. Even if you look in pre-season, how much higher we're playing up the pitch. It's like playing with a 12th man, isn't it, essentially?
Yeah, the way how high he was in midfield almost when we played against Real Madrid on his first game. And I know we lost the game, but for corners he was on the centre circle almost. It was unreal. Mm. Like that's so unheard of, isn't it, for Man United?
I think the big difference for me is his commandment of his area. If you look at kind of how he communicates with his back four, I think bypassing that press as well.
Yeah,
and it might actually change the approach of certain teams to United as well, because. I mean, you only had to look at the Champions League final of how easily he was able to beat Man City's press. You know, how often do you see goalkeepers doing that?
True. And the confidence he showed is one thing that will give the defence confidence, whoever is starting for United. But he had a bit of a ding-dong with Harry Maguire, didn't he, Miles? And berated him for a chance creation, the ball being given away in a dangerous area. It didn't lead to a goal, but there was a couple of chances and mistakes that did lead to a goal for Dortmund against United. It got... Maguire got the full ire of him in this particular occasion. Do you think that is something that we'll see a lot this season now? Because, I mean, I know De Gea was quite outspoken, but he was the creator of a lot of the trouble normally, but Onana was absolutely furious with him, wasn't he?
You'll see it a lot from Onana, but not necessarily directed at Harry Maguire, because I'm not convinced Maguire will be there come the end of the transfer window. But you see that from any goalkeeper that's got that sort of mentality and that sort of style of play. Look at how often you see Jordan Pickford screaming in a player's face. Emi Martinez is the first to tell you if you've done something wrong. When you are playing that philosophy and trying to play the ball out from the back like that and play around a press, it means that you have to be a unit. It's not about an individual can't make a mistake because it lets the whole side down so blatantly. It's not like a winger taking on a fullback and losing the ball. This is the most vulnerable position you can be in, and everything has to work in tandem. So Onana will be the first one to spot that if it goes wrong, because essentially that's what he's been brought in to do. He's a leader, and also the style has changed that because everyone knows that's what Onana is capable of. So if Maguire lets that down, the talking point will be Onana, won't it, if we're honest, because that's the reputation he comes with. It's really interesting to see how he settles into this United side. Obviously, we talked about it briefly, I think, last week. Ten Hag knows him well from their time at Ajax. I think it represents another bit of short-sightedness from Man United that they've signed this goalkeeper that's going to help Erik ten Hag for nearly 50 million when they could have had him on a free last year. And they've always known that De Gea wasn't going to suit ten Hag's style, but they've gone and done it eventually. That's the main thing. And it ultimately will help United in that sort of style. Whether it will be the most effective in improving their defence, I don't know. Because it depends on if everyone else can get on board.
Well, the defence is still an issue. Like we concede, I mean, a lot of teams have conceded goals in pre-season in a pretty bad way.
Don't look too much into that.
I won't read too much into it, but my concern is, playing out from the back, Maguire's not suited to that at all. West Ham made a cheeky, was it £20 million bid for him last week as well, or something really low ball?
Love that.
I don't know if David Moyes is just taking the mick there, but he's not going to stay at United. He can't do, but that begs the question, Dave. can we persist to play out from the back with Varane, Martinez and Lindelof as the only three really strong centre-backs that can deal with that?
I think what it does there, and you're mentioning there about, you know, the lapses in concentration and the mistakes that we've been making in pre-season, and you can't just highlight United in that. I've seen a few games in pre-season and there's been some terrible defending, but it can't help, I suppose, the security of the back four. The one thing that stood out for me in this pre-season, some of the pitches have been absolutely terrible, and a lot of players have been picking up knocks. But obviously, Varane was, I think, a precaution for this game as well. I think he was rested. So it can't help when you've got an unsettled back four. I don't want to keep blaming that, but it also highlights the weaknesses that we've got on our squad. This is still a transition for United, a rebuild job, not just for the first 11, but the squad. You look at the likes of Man City, Chelsea even now, who've obviously are strengthening thoroughly. We need to have a better squad who are capable of actually playing, obviously, Ten Hag's in his style. And there's still players in there that just aren't good enough.
Well, it's quite clear he's going to play youth ball, though, isn't it? From this pre-season, he's put a lot of faith in young players.
It's crazy, actually, to be fair. Some of the younger players have actually played better than the senior players.
I think so,
I don't think that's that crazy with your squad depth.
No. It probably should be the case, though, to be fair, because you get youngsters in there, they're looking to make a difference and obviously stake a claim in kind of cementing a spot in your squad for the upcoming season. But I mean, I don't read too much into it, the performances and the results, just because I think we had a really good pre-season last year and we got absolutely battered our first two games of the season. Against Brighton and Brentford, so I'm not going to read too much into it, but it would be nice to us to start scoring a few goals, because I think we've only scored 7 goals in our 5 games in pre-season, which doesn't obviously fill me with confidence.
It's weird, isn't it, how many Premier League teams have gone to the US for pre-season, and there must be so much money in it. We've even seen like Wrexham go there, haven't we, and draw some big crowds. So the US has been a bit of a draw for pre-season games. I think that'll probably be a fixture going forward now. And I think some of the Premier League banners around the stadiums as well made you feel like it was almost trying to emulate a Premier League game in many ways. So the fans must have really enjoyed it. But Villa have been out there, haven't they, as well, Miles? And all in all, we've seen some good performances. Again, some shambolic defending, it's fair to say. Some end-to-end ding-dong games. And the last one against Brentford as well was a good example of the good, the bad and the ugly of where squads are generally. But Moussa Diaby, we spoke about him, or you did, in some depth in the last pod. He's scored 2-2 now in pre-season. And, you know, there's a lot of players in that squad that deserve recognition for how they've come good this pre-season. But him in particular settled in really quickly, hasn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting to see him settling that quickly when he's playing quite a different role as well. We're used to seeing him for Leverkusen coming off the wing. And actually, there were times where he does that, absolutely. And there were times we saw him do that against Brentford. But it almost seems like they want to play him just behind Watkins and kind of play that second striker role. And the link up that the two of them seem to have already is amazing. And what we know, Watkins is really good at that because he does the runs that he needs to. He's really unselfish as a player. He'll always connect with another forward. But just generally speaking, considering he's only been at the club about a week, made 2 appearances and got 2 goals, shows the strength of how versatile he is as a forward, how skilled he is, and how good Emery is as a coach. We saw it in this game perfectly because they had the drinks break, and if anyone was watching on NBC or Sky, they focused in on Brentford while they were having the drinks break, and you could see Thomas Frank on the pitch with a whiteboard going through tactics, and they were really praising Frank, saying, wow, look at the depth he's going into, look how amazing this insight is to get to know his tactical knowledge, he's got this spot on. And then straight after the drinks break, what you didn't see was what Emery was saying, because Villa went and scored twice straight away. Like, they killed them. There was this spell for about 10 minutes where all of a sudden Villa went, right, we'll have this then. Yeah. And it started with Konsa and his excellent solo goal, which it was fortunate to have such poor defending, but it was Alan Hutton-esque, as many people will remember.
I saw that, it was very reminiscent, wasn't it? And to be honest,
even further back.
He was lucky to redeem himself because he didn't concede the penalty for Brentford's first goal.
Yeah, he did, and he should have known better, really. Yeah. It was always going to happen, if we're honest. And Villa playing the high line that they want to under Emery, it is a threat. They thought they played him offside, and he was in his own half, so it didn't work very well. And then Conte had a lot of work to do to catch up with him. But that it is what it is with that. I think you're right, pre-season never really shines favourably on the defending teams, does it? You always seem to be working on attacking players more than your defensive structure, which I find bizarre. But it's really noticeable. It's really, really noticeable. But Villa looked really sharp. Diaby was a massive part of that. And to do that against Premier League opposition is really encouraging. I do think I'm a bit cynical about the US tour because obviously they've been pushing to get a Premier League game played out in the US for as long as possible. And this was as close to it as they're ever going to get, I think. But there was good crowds, good support and good opposition that you actually need to try and figure out. It's funny because we play Newcastle out there and we've got them first game of the season. So you wonder how true a reflection of how Villa are going to line up that would have been was. But no, it's been great. It's a shame we didn't win that competition. If we hadn't conceded the goal to Brentford that tied the game up, we would have won it. But there's definitely some other successes from it as well. There's a couple of other players that probably deserve looking at.
There's so many opinions on where Villa will finish this season because their transfer window has been so remarkable, hasn't it? And do you know, I don't know if you saw, or you probably did, but the body cam footage on Yuri Tielemans and on Bruno Guimaraes as well. Wasn't that an eye-opener? And do you know what? If the Premier League introduced that as a regular fixture, I'll be watching that on YouTube regularly. It was a real insight. But it's good to see Villa actually performing quite well, seeing some signings coming good. Dave, it's interesting from an outsider's point of view, isn't it? Because, I mean, I'm looking at United's progress and thinking, you know, we should really be pushing for some kind of title challenge now or top two. But I think Villa have got a realistic chance of breaking that top four and overtaking United, don't you? It's worrying to see some rivals below us that were actually quite a gap below us at the start of last season, closing it so quickly, right?
Before Dave answers that, can I just let both of you know that doing this podcast with me will be hell for both of you if Villa finish above Man United at the end of next season.
Credit where it's due, though. If it happens, then, you know, we'll be the first to go fair play. But yeah, I can imagine you gloating to the very end. But no, back to Dave. What's your take on Villa's chances this season? I know it's premature, but they're building really well, aren't they?
It seems like a bit of a stretch when you said that. I was just thinking...
Is it?
Top four is, but then if you think about if teams obviously don't perform like they did last season, obviously look at the likes of Liverpool, Tottenham were terrible, Chelsea were abysmal. If things fall into place for Villa, and if they do start how they finish off last season, then, you know, it's all to play for. It's really unpredictable, isn't it, this season? And I was just literally just thinking, we could actually see the champions at the end of the year with probably one of the lowest total points because everyone's capable of beating each other. And I think that's the scary thing, actually, is that those at the top, for instance, City, they've not really invested so much. You can't, like, obviously previous years have brought in a couple of players and have kind of maintained that gap.
Yeah.
But it's if anything, the gaps are starting to narrow. Everyone around is strengthening and obviously building their squads.
There's no project close to City's, though, is there? That's the thing. City's project is so far advanced that I can't see many clubs. Maybe Arsenal, they've spent big. They've rolled the dice big, haven't they, this summer? They're the only real true contenders, I think, to the title. But top four, as you say, I think is competitive, surely.
But also, remember, there's a change to the Champions League structure as well. So it's actually likely that it'll be the top five.
Yeah,
from the Premier League, they get in this season, and Villa have to be earmarking that. They finished seventh last season.
Yeah,
they've invested very well this summer. You've got clubs like Newcastle who are now competing in the Champions League where they weren't last season. That's going to put a drain on their resources. Ultimately, we don't know what to expect of the likes of Liverpool, Chelsea, and Spurs who had off seasons last season, but Villa have to target the top six as a minimum. Yeah. And if they can sneak into fifth, I can't explain how happy I would be with that. Well, it'd be ridiculous.
With Juventus out of European competition now, the Conference League looks theirs, really, surely. They're the favourites, right?
When they're seeded in the draw, which helps. But yeah, the squad we've got, the money we've spent on the squad, we've got by far the biggest budget in the competition. We should be absolutely walking it, to be totally honest.
Is an interesting one. How would you compare your team probably against Newcastle? That, like, because I think that's the perfect first matchup for Villa, I think, and it will show you exactly sort of where you are. Yeah,
very interesting.
I'll be honest, and I'll probably get pelters from Newcastle fans for this. There might be two players in Newcastle's starting 11 that I would put in Villa's 11.
100% agree. Your team's better than Newcastle's. That's the first Trippier 11 and the
and maybe
squad.
Isak.
Yeah, I think take. Villa are streets ahead.
Yeah, I
Bruno?
Not over Villa's midfield, I'll be totally honest. Not over Douglas Luiz or Kamara.
The depth and in Villa's midfield as well, Dave. Villa's midfield especially is probably one of the best in the Premier League.
And do you know what's really encouraging? There was some really bright spots in pre-season from his name's left my head. Oh, Jadon Philogene.
Yeah.
He was excellent. He was Cardiff's young player of the season last year, and he got his chance under Emery. I think there was a lot of talk that him and Archer were both kind of playing to see if either of them would go out on loan. You couldn't loan Philogene out with the way he was playing. He looked absolutely electric, and he covered the wing. He covered an attacking midfield slot, and he covered fullback at one point. And seeing that Villa are still developing their academy, over the last 3-4 years, they've been really good at like cherry picking the best young talent across the country and bringing them in. And we've not seen enough of them come to fruition, really. Like, you look at when we brought in Louis Barry, for example, from Barcelona, he's just gone out on loan again. But if Philogene is going to jump the pecking order there, that's excellent. So we're spending in the transfer market, but we're also being quite savvy with our young products as well. That's what a club needs to do to build up. And I know Newcastle have got that as well. They've got one young lad who came into the team. His name's left my mind. I think his name's Elliot.
Elliot Anderson.
Elliot Anderson, that's it. Yeah, he looks really sharp. But I think they're very measurable projects. But Newcastle got Champions League to contend with, which is going to be more of a strain on their resources than Villa in the Conference League. Because Villa could field a second strength 11 for most of that competition.
Yeah, I feel like Eddie Howe has actually got the maximum out of a lot of the players that he already had at Newcastle. I don't think he can get much more. Whereas I think there's a lot of Villa players that were, yes, underperforming before Emery got there, but they've still got another level to kick on because they are so young. And that's the development kind of ceiling for them is so much higher than the Newcastle players in the squad.
Not even just the young ones, though. There are some that are not old, but more established in the team that Emery's not got to work with yet. Like Matty Cash.
Yeah.
Last season, Matty Cash missed a massive chunk when Emery first came in. And there was a lot of talk about us probably buying a right back this summer or maybe Konsa moving over. Actually, he played in the summer series and he looked brilliant. And you could hear Emery calling to him from the touchline. And it seems like they've got a good understanding. And all it will depend on is, obviously, we know that Emery likes for one fullback to bum on and the other one to tuck in. Now, Cash is definitely the one to bum on. That's what we want to see him doing. And if Moreno's on the other side, it's quite hard to do that. But actually, in Moreno's absence at the start of the season, Cash could cement himself in there and improve his game under Emery. That would be really rewarding. We've seen McGinn already improve. That will continue.
Yeah.
What can Tielemans do under this coach? It's definitely the best coach he's ever had in his career. So I think Villa have got bags of potential, and I like that it's being recognised to some degree because I think the pressure will almost help them in this case.
Yeah.
Do you think that with the calibre of players that they brought in the transfer window, because I don't think you could have anticipated the kind of players that they have brought in.
No.
Do you think it sort of changed their direction they're looking to go in? Because if you ask, like for instance, if you ask me before these transfers, I thought Villa probably would have been prioritising Conference League next season. Yes, they obviously would have wanted a good run, maintain consistency in the league and follow on from last season. But do you think they've sensed a real opportunity in the league this season because of the players that they've been able to bring in? Do you think there's going to be more of a priority prioritising the league over the Conference League because they think they can get in the Europa League, they think they can get into the Champions League?
From an internal point of view, no. I think this has always been the plan. I understand why you would look at Villa from last season and think that. And I think the appointment of Emery, who we know is excellent in cup competitions, it makes a lot of sense for that to be an area of focus. And if it is, great. We've seen plenty of great managers target higher European competitions by winning the one that they're currently in. Emery's done it to great effect with Sevilla. Mm-hmm. We've seen Mourinho do it last season as well. It's not a bad tactic. But Villa's mission was always to get themselves back to where they belonged in the league. These signings are definitely helping them get there, but I don't think it's that much ahead of schedule. I think the thing that was the turning point was the managerial appointment. I think you said, like, would I have expected these names coming in the summer? Pau Torres was obviously quite heavily linked for a while because of his connection with Emery, and neither of the other two were even on my radar as possible Villa signings. But am I surprised that we've got that kind of pull? No, because we've got probably the third or fourth best manager in the league, in my opinion, at our club. We're a club with massive wealth, massive history, European history. Mm-hmm. That's a big pull. And Villa have been really steadily investing in the project and trying to get year-on-year growth. They've made mistakes along the way. Of course they have. The Steven Gerrard era will go down as a mistake, but something that they clearly learned from. And now they're investing in the right places to make sure that doesn't happen again. You can't tell me that Villa will finish in the bottom half of the table this season with what they're doing now. No. And that's been the project always.
Exciting times for Villa fans, and we said that last time on the podcast, didn't we? You were the most excited you've been for a Villa season in probably your lifetime, I would probably guess. So
yeah, comfortably,
which is mental. In the space of 12 months, the way Villa fans are seeing their prospects is it's the biggest change in a club, I think, since probably Newcastle. But it's a lot more organic than Newcastle, and I think that's the nicest thing.
And look, the market's still open. Things could massively change. All of a sudden, a side could come sniffing around Emi Martinez. I don't think he'd leave, but you never know. And I look at our squad and there are definite holes in there that we need to plug. Martinez's backup being one of them. If he picked up a season-ending injury, then we probably would finish bottom half because Robin Olsen's the biggest drop-off for a backup keeper in the Premier League. Yeah. It's ridiculous. So there are things that need to be done still, but I think we might do a few little bits of smart business. I don't think there'll be any kind of sign into the profile of Diaby or Torres or Tielemans, but I think they'll continue to work on the squad, particularly if they can shift a few out, because there's still some on the books from back in the Championship days that probably need to move on. The likes of Courtney Hawes, Keenan Davies, they're still there.
Yeah, that's
natural. I imagine Bertrand Traore might move on. Yeah, and that's, I'll be sad to see some of them go, because they've been a massive part of this Villa project. They've helped build my club back to where it should be. We're in the Championship for 3 years, 4 years ago. Like, where we are now, that's a massive part of Villa's history all of a sudden. It's been a huge project. And seeing where that could go, yeah, it's massively exciting.
Another thing that's actually sparking excitement now, I think, after the game against Denmark, is England's progress in the Women's World Cup. So we'll move on to that next. And it's bittersweet, really, because obviously England are all but almost guaranteed, I think, progression now with that win, 2 out of 2. Only 2 goals, but 3 points is 3 points at this stage, and that's all that matters. Denmark were a very tricky opposition. They're always going to be a couple of world-class players there. But it seems like England have got a few world-class wild cards of their own. I think, Dave, the first one I want to mention is Lauren James. Started, and deservedly so, in this game, and scored an absolute peach of a goal. Now, she's surely in contention now, isn't she, for the next group game? And I think at the expense of probably Ella Toon, because stylistically she seems to sort of fit the same position, like a number 10, especially with, as we'll talk about in a minute, Kira Walsh not being there. But what a goal from James, Dave. How much did you rate that?
Yeah, oh, brilliant goal. I think just how she received the ball sort of on the half turn and kind of obviously, I think it's a bit of a shame really, because Ella Toon and Lauren James, I think without doubt, are probably the two best technicians in this team. Technically on the ball, there's something else.
James is so unpredictable, though. I think that's what makes her so strong in this kind of tournament environment.
Yeah, she's got that about her. She's a match winner. She can decide a game on her own, and obviously we saw it in this moment. Let's be honest, England have been nowhere near their best so far in this tournament, and there are obviously tweaks and changes that they've had to make, obviously because of injuries and the sorts, but I just feel as though she needs to be in this team. But I also feel like you need to have Ella Toon in there.
Well, the makeup of the midfield is going to change.
Both started last game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think what I was going to ask you, Miles, next is obviously with Kira Walsh missing, she's such a huge void in that team. And she's one of a handful of truly world-class players that England have. And she's almost irreplaceable, isn't she? She was instrumental in the Euros win. And I think Serena Weigman trusts her so much that she'll probably put two holding midfielders in to replace her now in the next game. That's the talk. And obviously, Laura Coombs came in for her to replace her as she was injured. What do you think that Serena Weigman's move will be to kind of fill that gap left by Walsh? Because it's a conundrum, isn't it? It changes the forward play slightly as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think particularly when you consider the defensive injuries that England have had, the security that Walsh gave England at the back was so vital. Yeah. You've got Millie Bright, who's only recently back from injury herself. We're missing Leah Williamson already. So to lose another integral part of England's defensive structure and someone who's so good at winning the ball back and screening that back four, that's huge. Seeing Laura Coombs come on, I was a little surprised, to be totally honest. She's had an excellent season with Man City, like comfortably her best season. But this is her first sort of exposure to international football at this sort of level. And she's 32. Whereas you've got Jordan Nubbs on the bench, who's got 71 caps for England. To me, that's the most obvious replacement. I'd be nervous to watch England completely change their structure of the midfield, particularly when, yes, they've kept two clean sheets so far, but they've only scored twice and only once from open play. And we talked last week, didn't we, Dave, about how goal scoring had become a bit of a problem for England. And I said I thought it was essential that Rachel Daly got in the squad. You said you thought it was essential that Laura James got in, and then it was a Rachel Daly assist and a Laura James goal, which made me feel very vindicated. But because of that and their kind of, I would still say, struggles going forward, I wouldn't want to move the midfield to an overly defensive structure.
Yeah.
And I think Jordan Nubbs is perfectly capable of fulfilling that role. She's someone who can contribute going forward as well. I've seen her at Villa this season. Signing her on loan was an excellent move, and it really helped develop how Villa's midfield operated, having that experience and someone who's been at the top level. And I think that could do the same job for England in this case. It is a shame about Ciara Walsh, though. It was so sad seeing her go down, because she knew it was over. I think she said to the bench that she'd done her knee, and her teammates came over to try and help her, and she was like, no, get off.
No.
Like, it clearly broke her heart, and it would, because, like you say, she's absolutely vital to that team.
But young enough to, really still, to still come back on the biggest stage for the next World Cup. So it won't be the last we'll see of her at a World Cup, that's for sure. But, I mean, she had a chance to really put her mark on this tournament, like she did at the Euros. And women's ACL injuries are so prevalent now, aren't they, in the game? And there's not that much research into it yet, but it seems to be a really problematic thing for female footballers to suffer from ACLs. So sad as it is to see her go, it will create an opportunity for somebody else. And I think that's the options available to Serena Weigman, is that she's got the opportunity to maybe put Coombs in or Nobbs. I think Stanway might be probably the fall girl from this. She might have to drop a little bit deeper.
Maybe, yeah.
Just to kind of give more license to roam for Toon or James, because I think they're both very much like wild cards going forward.
They're nailed on now.
I'm gutted to not see Daly start up front, although it's great to see her still show her range of passing, for example, for the assist. Russo, is Alessia Russo going to play the next game? Because she's misfiring, isn't she? She's getting into some great positions, but she can't find the net. And I can't help but thinking, if that was Rachel Daly in half of those, she'd have put the ball in the back of the net easily.
I can't work out whether it's better to keep her in the side, knowing that we're pretty much already through, and give her another 90 minutes to try and find the back of the net.
Probably.
Or whether now is the perfect opportunity to experiment and put Rachel Daly up front and give her 90 and see which one looks more successful. It's really interesting. And I think Weigman will probably stick with her, because we know that she likes to be quite loyal to her players. She uses a smaller amount in her starting 11, like she did in the Euros. So I think we will see Russo again. I would probably prefer to see Daly there. It's frustrating watching Rachel Daly play left back. It's ridiculous to me, particularly when Villa have got a young English left back who has been phenomenal all season. And I'm watching Maz Pacheco watch the World Cup rather than be in it, whereas she should be providing for Daly up front. It's mental to me.
I think it's even more annoying when Alex Greenwood's in the team and not playing left back.
Yeah.
And you've got Rachel Daly in there.
It's difficult because she's done so well in that role for England, and because she is such a fantastic footballer, but you are nullifying the biggest threat in the WSL last season. That's what it feels like. And yeah, her link-up play in the middle of the pitch against Denmark seemed really good. Obviously, she laid the ball off for Lauren James, but then defensively, she didn't look that strong against Denmark, really. She was doing a lot of running backwards. And there were the first half an hour of the Denmark game, England absolutely dominated, and they looked all over them. And then all of a sudden, Denmark started asking some questions, and that defence started to look a bit more fragile. If it weren't for our mate Mary Earps, who we were singing her praises last week again, then it might have been a different result. England have got to be really careful, because they've got bigger opposition to come.
It just shows, doesn't it, how much of a loss Leah Williamson is, because I think she's so quick to try and get Millie Bright back in that defence, that she's overseen, I'm going to to another horn here of Maya Letizia at Man United. Didn't get a call up. She's had a great season. She'd have been a great replacement for Williamson at centre-back, but she just doesn't trust the defence to hold. So she's putting Greenwood at centre-back, isn't she, and making Daly a left-back. And that's just bad luck for Daly, really, isn't it?
It's got to be a bit demoralising as a centre-back in that squad, though, and not even getting giving you a chance when, you know, it's like a Luke Shaw, Harry Maguire moment, isn't it? Almost.
But speaks volumes of Daly's professionalism as well, that she's just willing to slot in at left-back. It's an amazing opportunity to play at the World Cup, and I think you'd play anywhere if you were given a starting spot, but the fact that she's that versatile and can do that is
unbelievable. Do you think it's a case of trying to get shoehorn all of your best players in an 11?
A bit. And actually, this is one thing that I almost worry about from the women's game, that if you are trying to build the profile of it on a international scale in a tournament like this where all eyes are on it, it's not the best narrative to watch your striker playing left back just because she's better than
someone else. No, but the majority of caps have been there, though, for Daly. I think Weidman's played most.
I think that's because the development of young English talent hasn't been there for years, and we've not developed that many good defenders, realistically. Mm. So Dave's right. It's a case of Rachel Daly's an excellent footballer, so we can just put her anywhere. You wouldn't see that for the England men's team. No. You wouldn't see Harry Kane playing left back. Well, I say that, maybe you would. He was sitting here in Trippier playing left back at enough times, and Kyle Walker playing centre back. Maybe I'm talking rubbish. But it just seems to me that if you want to excel the progress of the reputation of England women's, you've got to have a really good structure. And I don't think it's the best optics to put the WSL's top scorer at left back because you can't find anyone else. I think you could have found someone else.
Yeah, true. Anyway, to wrap up the pod, guys, I'm going to move back to the men's game and to Saudi Arabia, actually, who continue to sign star players unabated. And Jordan Henderson's made the move to Saudi. He's followed Steven Gerrard to Al-Ettifaq, as he said in his broad accent. It's a weird one.
It's boyhood club, he said, didn't he? Did he say he's always been a fan, he couldn't wait to put the jersey on?
I don't know how he can justify moving there, apart from obviously filthy cash. But it sits uneasy, doesn't it, with football fans to see a player who kind of pledged to be an ally for the LGBTQ community, wore the rainbow armband, ends up being just a token. And I think that stuck in my throat really the most was the way the presentation video showed this rainbow armband turn into black and white, like it was symbolic of something, an evolution of his career or something. I don't know what they meant by it, but it almost took away the fact that he was an ally back in England and he's now at Saudi Arabia. He's going to behave in a way that suits the culture. And I get the argument for saying that if you move to Saudi Arabia, respect the culture, but it's not a cultural thing. It's a blatant discrimination thing, isn't it? And how can Jordan Henderson live with himself knowing that he's kind of put all of that work that he's put into the inclusivity of everybody in football behind him for cash, Miles? How do you feel about it?
It's such an odd situation to find someone who's been the captain of Liverpool, and kind of organised the Premier League captains in their campaigns for support in a more inclusive environment in so many different ways, to so quickly do an about turn. It's not one that makes sense immediately. The motivation can only be one thing. It's not like it's something that's close to his heart, or culturally it's going to put him in an environment that he will be supportive of. In fact, it's the exact opposite of what he's been saying he believes for a really long time. And that's, I don't know, it's just, we've talked so much about so many areas of football right now taking away our kind of faith in the game a little bit. And every now and again, things happen that give you a bit more faith. And some of the things that Henderson has done and some of the other Premier League captains did as a collective, they were the things that were giving you faith. And seeing how easy it is for money to be the motivating thing to change his morals is a massive thing. If Jordan Henderson was of the faith or belief that matched up with those sort of stand-ins, then you'd have less of an argument against him. But when he's been so vocal in support, it's odd to see him move so quickly, because it can only be one thing, and it shows how easy it is to buy someone's favour. I'll be honest, the other thing that I found mental was how quick Southgate was to back him. Because supposedly, it's not been public, but supposedly Gareth Southgate said it won't affect whether he gets selected for England. Now, I'll be honest, I hope what he means by that is he shouldn't be getting selected anyway, but I don't trust that it does. And actually, I wonder if when you've built this squad and the harmony that it's got with its fans, what reception will Jordan Henderson get when he comes back to England now?
I think what Southgate meant by that was that despite the calibre of the league not being the same as the Premier League, he won't rule him out for consideration. But I think that's a polite way of paying respect to him as the player. I don't think he meant it in any kind of, you know, I don't mind you disregarding all the LGBTQ fight you've put in before. It is kind of not closing the door on a player that he respects, you know. And I do understand that to an extent. But I also kind of see the optics of that are kind of, they're a bit deluded, really, because he's never going to get to a level now where he's good enough to play for England.
He's gone there for a reason.
Yeah.
He probably wasn't going to play that much for Liverpool next season, particularly with the money that they spent on the midfield. What's his level after that? Well, nowhere he's going to get the kind of money he can get there. That's why he's gone there. And for me, that should rule you out of the international selection. I mean, not just that. Let's be honest. He's not good enough for England's midfield anymore.
No.
If we're totally honest, that should be the deciding factor. But I do think there is something to be said of someone being such a hypocrite and the way that England's fan base has grown to support the almost like a club side, right?
Yeah.
And they've got to know the personalities behind it and support them. It feels like Jordan Henderson has bought a lot of people's favour and kind of, is it virtual signalling where he's just kind of going, yeah, I'm going to hop on the biggest trend right now and get as much support as I can, if you're then going to go and pick up a 700 grand a week.
It undermines
you. 700
grand a week, I read.
Oh, my.
It's mind-boggling.
And this whole, you hear a lot about, you know, it's life-changing money.
They're already
and
on
it sets
that.
His family up. Yeah. Mate, do you know how much my life would change if I was on the salary of someone at Cardiff City?
Imagine £1 million per week.
Listen,
£1 million every single week as your paycheck.
It's ridiculous.
It's unfathomable. And for him to be going, actually, that's not life-changing enough for me, is even more gross in some ways, isn't it?
And again, I think it is vital that we make the distinction between, that's not disregarding that Saudi Arabia should have football, but while you've got suppressive laws, it is complicated, to say the least. And for Jordan Henderson to have been so vocal about how he supposedly felt about football and how that should be an inclusive environment, it's bizarre. It's absolutely bizarre.
Well, he's getting absolute pelters for it on social media, and I think rightly so. And we both listen to the Football Ramble, you know, it's a respected podcast, and they're really outspoken about this particular thing. And I agree with them 100%. It's, what level of wealth do you need to kind of go, that's worth me selling out for, about all my morals and principles? I can't get my head around it. Wealth is so huge at a Premier League level. Any level above that is just obscene, isn't it? That blows my mind.
Mm. And we've talked quite openly about how we're still coming to understand the Saudi Pro League because it's brand new to us.
Yeah.
Like, we were joking beforehand, weren't we, Dave, about that photo of Henderson saying he was looking forward to wearing the shirt of a club he'd never heard of 3 weeks ago. And to be honest, neither had we. And we are huge football fans. We watch as much football as possible. And I do think that we still need to do a bit of educating on what the Saudi Pro League is actually trying to do and what they're setting up. But on the surface, you can see only the things that are abhorrently wrong with it. And I want to, we've had conversations in the background, haven't we, about maybe talking to someone who has got a bit more exposure to the league and see what their intentions are. And that would be really fascinating to me.
Yeah.
But this one seems odd.
Dave,
doesn't it?
Dave, do you think there's a little bit of hypocrisy from English football fans, you know, where the Premier League, the only reason the Premier League is so successful is because it went, hang on a second, let's throw loads of money at this project. Is that not exactly the same thing as what the Saudi Pro League's trying to do now? Because the Premier League was not even the second or third best team league in Europe in the early 90s. In fact, from a hooliganism point of view, the Premier League was so tainted, or the Division One as it was known then, you could never see us rising to the top as a league, but we had to throw money at it to make it happen. What's the difference between that and the Saudi Pro League?
Yeah, I mean, I think the main thing is, obviously, Miles has just touched on a lot of the issues there. Obviously, is a lot of what's on the surface, I think, is what is getting a lot of criticism from fans. Obviously, if you look at the league itself, the kind of players that are actually going there now, and we spoke about, obviously, China tried to do something similar, didn't they? They could only kind of get players who were sort of almost over the hill. Actually, this league is now attracting players that are still in their peak. Obviously, you've got Marco Verratti. There's another name.
Well, that's another thing. I think it's close enough to Europe. Really, isn't it? It's close enough for Europe to not feel a million miles away. Whereas I think the Chinese league was so far away geographically that it changed lives completely, didn't it? Mm. Going to Saudi Arabia doesn't change a huge amount geographically, so you can still stay in touch with home to an extent, you know.
Particularly for some of the players that are going. If you notice that, I do notice there has been a particular targeting of like the higher profile Muslim players that are moving over there that obviously are more culturally linked to that kind of environment, which makes sense.
Yeah. But Jordan Henderson does not make much sense. I think we're unanimous.
A bit different. It is a bit different. But that's not to say that you can't move to a different culture. Like, that's something that England has grown off of, people that have done that. And if Saudi Arabia is looking to grow and develop, excellent. Do I think that Jordan Henderson is going over there to take his views on the LGBT community with him and be an advocate out there? No, I'll be honest. I don't think that is what he's doing. And if that's the case, then it is quite a big hypocrite, I guess. Yeah. But it's difficult, isn't it? It's really easy to sit here and judge anyone. What would we do? I like to think we all know the answer to that. Mm. But someone puts... I think that much money in front of anyone's nose, then they've got to think about it at least. It's refreshing when you see someone turn it down, and I mean, it's turned down for the right reasons. But
I suppose the money is the attraction. But I suppose when you're talking about obviously the Premier League, you know, the TV revenue that it obviously pulls in is obviously a big factor in why, you know, clubs in this league have got the finances that they have.
Yeah.
That's a pull in itself, obviously, the finances, but then playing in obviously one of the biggest leagues, you know, one of the most competitive leagues in the world is the main reason why players want to play in the Premier League. You know, it's the best of both worlds, whereas this is, you know, it's another animal altogether.
But they'll catch up with that, won't they? Yeah. It feels like if this project is long term, they'll catch up with it, because the difference between what you were saying, Mike, about the Premier League putting money into it to catch up with the likes of Serie A and La Liga was the scale was smaller.
Yeah.
Whereas now, starting from the bottom, and that's essentially what Saudi are doing, starting a league from nothing. It's not like Serie A are trying to keep up with the Premier League all of a sudden. You can only throw the quantity of money that they're doing at it, because otherwise you'd never get there. And we'd be talking years and great fortune and luck coming into play, essentially. The only way to do it is to orchestrate yourself. And the Premier League didn't really need to do it on the same scale, because England was always seen as the home of football. It had had European champions previously. England had won the World Cup. Yeah. We're talking about a culture that football is not necessarily recognised as being a part of it, now trying to get to the same level. And that is, if you haven't got the time for it, well, they've got the money. So that's how it's going to happen, I guess.
Do you think another one we've not mentioned, obviously, Victor Osimhen, I think he's been linked with going to the Saudi Pro League for 121 million. Does that...
Not a chance.
If that happened, does that when people stand up and take notice and actually say, probably, hang on, this is...
I don't think it needs to. And I think this is the thing. As long as Saudi clubs are being linked with players like that, we're talking about them. Mm. So it's still raising their profile, whether they get them or not. This bid for Kylian Mbappe, he didn't go. But how long were we talking about it?
True.
That's the kind of money and press that they're trying to draw across. The fact that players would even consider them, that's a huge step. Because we laughed at the idea of Spurs being interested in Mbappe, because we don't even think for a second that's a possibility. We all thought it was possible he could go to Saudi, though.
Yeah.
And that, would anyone have thought that 12 months ago? That's how much the profile of the league has risen already from pretty successful marketing and massive spending.
Yeah.
Well, that's business, I guess.
For balance and for playing devil's advocate as well, we'll always keep an open mind here, won't we? And, you know, we'll eat our words if it ends up being a project in 2-3 years' time that ends up being actually sustainable. Maybe we'll see Saudi youth players coming through. And that's the hope, isn't it? That the league and the communities there get their opportunity to show their worth as well. And maybe this is just the kickstart they need. But we'll see. We'll keep our options open. Guys, there's only a couple more pods left until the Premier League starts. Is it two? Is it one? It's not many, anyway.
Villa have still got two more games before the Premier League starts.
They're putting it fine, aren't they? But I cannot
wait. I'm also glad, Mike, I'm also glad, Mike, that you were back this week, because we'll be honest, we've been fielding a lot of questions and speculation over whether you'd taken a big money move to Saudi Arabia, or maybe you were out in the US on a pre-season tour. So it's a good job you're back with us this week, just to clear up those rumours. Can you get your loyalty payment tomorrow from staying with your club till August? Are you going to get a 70 million payout from us for not signing up for Saudi Arabia?
In short, no. Good. I am with the pod. I am going to stay with the pod, and no amount of money will lure me away.
We'll see.
But anyway, guys, thank you for your time again. It's great to have the three of us back for a podcast for the first time in about a month, it feels like, isn't it? And the Premier League's on the horizon, guys, not much longer to go. Women's World Cup still to look forward to, and the finale of that. Come on, Lionesses, see you at home. In the meantime, guys, thanks for listening. Hop over to wherever you listen to your pods, to YouTube, subscribe, follow, support us on every channel. We are at Football Diary UK. Follow us wherever, or even on TikTok now, who'd have thought? So get in there, give us a like, give us a follow, give us a mention, it all helps. In the meantime, guys, thank you. See you soon.